Thank you for tuning in to the Head Game Podcast, powered by Mindful Athlete Training, where you grab an inside look into the heads and minds of the high performer. Learn what they do and how they think to help you take control of your own head game.
Welcome to another episode of the Head Game, powered by Mindful Athlete Training. Today we talk about why mental isn't always the same as physical, how you can build awareness, acceptance, and take action. In addition, we'll be talking about the value of intention and what it means to disrupt mental health as it is today, so that we can embrace chaos, lean into it, and engage in a more fulfilling life. Enjoy another episode of The Head Game. Routine again? Say that again.
It's every day, but especially on Mondays, because of the weekend, you're coming off, you know, the weekend, is the ice shower, the 7-minute ice shower, which actually goes back to you, because we were talking about this earlier, and you said, when did you start first doing that? And I said, well, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Wim Hof.
Yeah, Wim Hof. Yeah, the Nordic legend.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you turned me on to, you know, his philosophy and his techniques and his access of the breath. And then the YouTube video where that group, what's the name of that group?
Yes Theory.
The Yes Theory. That's right. Of course, not the Yes Men or the Yes Women, but Yes Theory.
No. Yes Theory.
They went out and spent time with him, and they did the cold submersion in the, I guess I can call it like a brook, a portion of it. It wasn't big enough to call it a lake. Mm-hmm. They jumped off it was probably about 20, 25 feet, a ledge into it to kind of break the ice, no pun intended, with their trip. And then they did a, I think it was a 10-minute submersion. Was it 10?
Yeah, 10 minutes. And normally you have to build up to that training. Typically, they don't just jump into 10 minutes. Typically, they do like a 2-minute or a 5-minute. But they were just like, screw it, you're good. Wim is like, let's just do it. And they went for 10.
Well, they did have some experience with other types of things. So I guess he deemed them to be a little bit higher of candidates. For that type of their body to be receptive to that type of training anyway. And they kind of jumped, you know, both feet in, and they show the walking into the freezing water and slowly getting into it. And then, you know, seeing this warmth within build and obviously focusing on your breathing to aid with things like circulation, the anti-hypothermia. And I just kind of thought, is there any way that I could sort of simulate that without having access to, you know, frigid waters all year round? Mm-hmm. So I started to look into the cold shower, the ice shower, and the slow but sure increments up to 7 minutes. So I started off with 30 seconds, and I added 30 seconds every week. So it was about an 8-week process. And I got to tell you, the head game that you go through when you're doing the incremental time with the, I've never done a full ice submersion out in the wild. I used to do that in my football days, for recovery purposes after
you
a
mean
game,
like the cold, the
we
cold
get
tub?
Into the, yes. Yeah. They're called cold tubs now. Because they're actually state-of-the-art cold tubs that are built in training facilities. And back in my day, I'm dating myself a little bit, late 80s, early 90s, it was just a giant trash can filled with ice and topped off with water. And you would get in and you would go full neck.
Right.
There was the, you know, whirlpool for the contrast bath, and that was much more scientific in aiding in your body's recovery. But I got to tell you, the challenge of the shower is that you're not getting all of your body exposed to the change in temperature all at once. Right. So just you're when just some getting, part of your body.
Right. You're just getting a little bit at a time. So what is it? As you kind of are approaching getting into this frigid cold shower, knowing you're about to put your body through a little bit of strain, like, what's the process like you for for doing this, and as you've built up to that 7-minute window for yourself, what has been that process for you, that head game that you say?
Well, it leads to a couple of things that I'm trying to embody the lifestyle of what we promote, of sort of leaning into discomfort, and more specifically, trying to embody the value of intention, of doing things with intention that make us uncomfortable. Because I mention it to clients, and they say they just go, you know, that's the first reaction, is because we've all been there when maybe we lose hot water or someone dumps a cold bucket of water on us when we're in the shower. Ha ha ha.
Yep.
You know, that's so funny. Mm-hmm. But to actually do it and lean in, and then do it with incremental stages of discomfort, because you read all about the physiological benefits, you know, right, how your right. nervous system is getting activated and shifting. We've emphasized the shift of the intentional shift of physiology and yep. being more aware and more cognizant of what that does, of what that can bring. Mm-hmm. And it's really become just part of my everyday now. The interesting thing, which I didn't really come into realization, is after I had done it, I've been doing it for about 3 months now.
Okay. Nice.
When I first started to do it, I was doing it in the Northeast, in the Philadelphia area, and I had been getting very accustomed to, you know, those temperatures. My son at the time was on a recruiting trip, and we were up at Colgate University in Hamilton, New York.
I decided to continue
that 7 minutes, and obviously the cold water in February is a hell of a lot chillier in Hamilton, New York, about 250 miles north of Philadelphia as the crow flies, versus where I was. But aside from my struggle, because I wasn't making the 7 minutes consistently the 2 days that I was in Hamilton, what was even more interesting was when I returned to the Philadelphia region and I did my first 7 minute about 36 hours later. My first reaction when I got in was, huh, this isn't cold at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And I found that so interesting because of what we promote and what we teach and our theories.
You were experiencing something more difficult, if you will, or more challenging, that extreme cold, if you will. And that is creating this. When I come back to whatever that cold or that perception of cold was, it's no longer a limitation. It becomes just, oh, I can do this much simpler because I did more, right?
It was just another experience. Yeah.
Right.
But back to the 7 minutes though, in increasing my time, you want to talk about the head game that you play with yourself, the negotiation. I find this so interesting. The negotiation of self, of trying to buy yourself an extra 30 seconds, an extra 60 seconds, trying to shift your focus and attention from the internalization of pain and discomfort to the externalization of what your day might be like, who you're going to see later, what responsibilities that you have, what things you're looking forward to, the back and forth, the interplay, the mental interplay, I found fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that negotiation piece, right? And we've talked about this before, and it's not so much trying to focus on it. I guess let me ask you in particular, what were you trying to focus on as your mind started a race to how much longer do I have?
I tried to shift it again away from the pain and discomfort. It took me back to some injuries that I had in my college football days of not assigning attention in general to the pain and discomfort, knowing that it was distracting me from my responsibilities that were on field, and trying to bring myself back. What I didn't even realize, Hunter, was that I was really starting to practice this notion of intentional shift without really having a definition of what it really was. Operationally, I was doing it, but I didn't really know what to call it or what it was. It was more of my survival mode at that time. And I think when you're in a bit of pain and discomfort and you find your mind racing, you try to ground yourself. I think it's what human nature encourages. in making that shift.
Yeah. So what allowed you to ground yourself? So you're not focusing on the pain right now. You're trying to focus on something else. What are you focusing on? What's the intention that you're trying to focus on that allows you to make that shift?
It's really just, for me, it was trying to experience what the origin of the discomfort, trying to revisit the notion that it's temporary, that it's not going to last forever, that it has a shelf life. I think, again, is probably a more advanced coping skill that some might suggest in more of an underdeveloped capacity is avoidance. But I think the more that you embrace the discomfort and see it at when you know you're doing it with intention, it gives you more control. The right. perception of control shifts; it alters within you. It's more proactive versus reactive.
Yeah, I like the perception right of that. Right, it's how you're viewing it. It's what we talked about last week with stress as information. It's the perception of that. System or that pain that you're giving a different value to. So what you're doing is you're giving it a different value of instead of trying to avoid that pain completely, you're identifying that pain as how do I explore it more? You're leaning into it.
I think it's what so many people struggle with today in our world. You and I have talked about this. It's we've gotten so conditioned to reacting the same way because by no means am I belittling what we've gone through as a society the last few years, but we're not experiencing anything new for the first go-round that this generation or two generations has seen before 100 years ago, 200 years ago. It might be, in our mind, the perception of more modern, of more current, which makes it more relevant. Because of science, because of technology, we get exposed to that information quicker. But it is no different of what our ancestors have experienced before us as it relates to how they were living and what substantiated their existence. I think we've gotten far too conditioned to just having that mental script of reactivity being the status quo, which I think is so much a lesson we can learn. Where and why has the concept of disruption provided us opportunity to learn more about ourselves?
Well, it's interesting that you said disruption. It's the thought that was coming up in my mind. You're talking about this reactivity. And I feel sometimes that disruption or moments of disruption are the moments that people realize. And I think this goes back to last week as well. Right, they realize I need to make a change. And I think the imperative notion is, why is disruption important? Why is radical change important? And how do we devise and create that within our own lives?
I think that's a great question. Let me take it one step further back. Do people have the capacity to see disruption and radical change as anything positive?
I think people see it as this is upsetting my stasis. This is upsetting my balance of the world or how I see the world. And that's completely shifting them. The other part I think that goes along with disruption significantly is a lack of a plan. I've told you this before. I like Formula One, right? So I was watching Formula One in Miami 2 weeks ago. And one of the drivers, his name is Charles Leclerc, is a driver for Ferrari. And Ferrari has been in the lead this past year, but Red Bull is close behind them. But Ferrari's initial plan, which they call Plan A, wasn't working. So what they said was, okay, let's go to strategy or Plan D, right? And in our minds, well, they're obviously shifting from the initial plan, but they have a plan nonetheless, which gives them a strategy, which gives them the best opportunity to potentially still win that race. Right. So they had a plan in place, what helps them to kind of quell maybe some of that stress because they have an alternative. They know what to do when disruption does occur, right? They've planned it out. They've thought ahead. They've been proactive about it. They're looking at all of the data to try to best assess what should we do if this happens. And I think a lot of people don't do that. So when disruption comes, it becomes a negative because they don't have a plan in place. They haven't proactively read the data or strategized about it. So disruption immediately becomes this negative entity because they don't have a plan B, or if they have to switch to a plan B or even a plan D, they think that's bad. But plan D still gives you the best possible chance. It just might not be as ideal, but doesn't mean that it's not as good.
See, that's interesting because, and this is, I love what you're saying about the additional plans or the ability, because we say that having multiple plans is really having more intention with alternatives, adaptation, just the ability to shift, right? Mm-hmm. But you would also find that some would suggest the only way, and this is just an interesting narrative that I find has been really communicated across the airwaves as of late, the only way to fully commit, I want your response on this concept for what some might consider as the only way to do things. If you have a plan B, that suggests that you're not all in with plan A. How do you feel about that?
I think it's not about your, so I want to just clarify. Are you saying because I have a plan B, I'm not 100% committed to plan A?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think that that's accurate. I think you can be completely committed to plan A unless the variables have shown themselves, right? So if there has been a change, if there's been a shift, if there's been chaotic elements that have been a result of it, those variables are present, whether we want them to be or not, they are. And so plan B, or having a plan B and C, is ultimately you giving yourself the best opportunity. So the more that you fight the resistance of, hey, I want plan A, I want plan A, I want plan A, but all the variables are requiring you to go to plan B, it doesn't mean that you're neglecting plan A. Plan A was the entire intention. But because you have a plan B, it actually reinforces your likelihood of what your process looks like to reach to your final outcome. So I don't think it's so much that you're not in plan A. I think it's you're fully committed to plan A, but plan B, C, or D is as a result of, hey, there's some variables that change. This is going to give us the best possible opportunity to be successful.
You make me think of what we often discuss with our clients, which is our AAA model. You know, the awareness, the acceptance, and action. You know, the stages by which we feel can help with that ascension to peak mm-hmm. performance, right? Mm-hmm. And to become more aware of what are the variables, the very variables that you're speaking of mm-hmm. that warrant more attention, more flexibility. Are we accepting that that needs some type of different approach? Because what we're really saying is the only way that you get to action is to go through that stage of being more aware and accepting that something needs to change because of it.
Right. Yeah. So you're talking about those AAAs, the awareness, acceptance, and action. And I think awareness is a really interesting piece. And it's really that initial piece that's going to spurn everything else. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is how our mental fitness, right? How people can engage in their mental fitness more often, you know, from the psychological perspective, encouraging people to engage more. And, you know, you talk about this awareness, but a lot of people don't know what they don't know. I was listening to a broadcast of it might've been the Dodgers versus the Red Sox or the Braves versus the Red Sox, but the starting pitcher had a mental skills coach. And I say that specifically because a mental skills coach can be somebody who is supporting them in putting mental skills together. And a lot of times what I talk about with mental skills, a lot of times is the knowledge. It's understanding what is happening and the information of what is occurring mentally. But that doesn't necessarily always translate to mental application. And I believe mental fitness allows people to have that application where mental skills is really important. And the reason why I say that is I think a lot of people don't know what they don't know. And that is tends to be this, there's four different kind of competency elements, kind of stages that we go through. You know, you talk about awareness. Awareness for people is they don't know what they don't know. So what we call that is unconscious incompetence. And unconscious incompetence is allowing that for that aha moment. You just don't know what you don't know. The next is conscious incompetence. That means you're aware of something, but you're not quite sure how to get it. And I think a lot of people are here too. Now that mental fitness or even mental health is talked about more, people are more aware of it, but they're not quite sure how to go there. And so there's going to be a lot of learning and change that happens and some missteps along the way that you jump from that conscious incompetence to conscious competence. This is where a lot of people start, but they tend to stop. Conscious competence is, I have the skills now, or at least I have the resources, but now I have to put out effort. And I have to put out effort to make those changes occur, right? So if you think about your three A's, unconscious incompetence is awareness, right? You need that awareness to jump to that conscious incompetence, right? You need to be accepting of the skills that you lack and finding what needs to be happening. And then conscious competence is you need to take action. You need to take action to make those things occur. And I said there were four things. And the final fourth thing, this is really important because this is where you can activate it, right? Versus where conscious competence is a lot of effort that you're putting out. Unconscious competence is this mastery. To get to unconscious competence, you need to work on it. It's not something that just happens. So we're talking about this shift, this disruption, right? That occurs. But if we're always seeing disruption as this negative, we're really never going to be able to create mastery because we're going to be judging it constantly. We're always going to be putting resistance to it versus naturally shifting and making that unconscious competence to say, okay, well, I have this range of skills and I'm capable of putting all of them into place, you know? And I think that's an important skill. And we talk about that a lot with the mental, right? Like we are aware of it. We eat, sleep, and breathe it. And a lot of our athletes and the people that we work with, executives, Air Force pilots, Army Green Beret, they're using it more and more. And we're encouraging them to think about their mental. But I guess, are people thinking about their mental the same way as physical? Like, I'm wondering about, you know, how people have viewed their physical and why that might be a little bit more of an unconscious competence or even a conscious competence in terms of like, hey, I know what I'm doing and I put out effort. Like, why don't you think, I guess, people mentally are there?
I think the conscious competence is definitely something more consistent, more analogous to the physical model. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's things that you can see. Mm. You can see when you're out of shape. You can see when you need to lose a few pounds.
Right.
You know on a Monday, if you had a heavy, you know, food and drink kind of weekend, that you're sweating profusely much sooner in your workout. You get these, for lack of a better term, warning signs that your physical body gives you. I think for the mental, in so many instances, let's face it, we have gotten numbed over the last few years through what life has thrown at us. We've been asked to choke down a lot. And I think that for that reason, what you're really talking about with your unconscious incompetence and getting someone to eventual conscious competence, if I digested that correctly, what you're doing is you're the guide of mental fitness. You're kind of being that Sherpa, you know? You're telling them that the ascension, the climb up the stairs, is a very intentional process. Mm-hmm. But I think for most people, Hunter, especially still in today's world, and we are getting there slowly, the mental piece still is unfamiliar. It's still abstract. It's still taboo. It's not really talked about in the same capacity as the physical. Mm-hmm. We're so much conditioned at a younger age to mind ourselves physically, to take care of ourselves physically. I told you this story a number of months ago, the story of the little boy. Where it was highlighted on a reel, and you know, sometimes I'm not that good with names. It was highlighted on a reel with a British psychologist who was visiting friends. And they had a little boy. He was no more than maybe two and a half. They were sitting down for dinner, and he was having a conversation with his friend and his wife, and the little one was excited to try to show the new dinner guest something, and he had slipped and fallen, and he had cut himself. And what this little boy did was, on his own, independently, went to the bathroom. He got a step stool, which allowed him to reach above the sink into the medicine cabinet and pull out an antiseptic and a Band-Aid. He cleaned the wound and then put a Band-Aid over it and then proudly ran over to his parents just with this big grin on his face. Not, I slipped and fell, not I'm hurting, not someone please help me, but look how I engaged in self-care.
Right, I took care
of it. And this Buddhist psychologist had this moment and said, why can't we learn to do that for ourselves mentally?
Yeah.
And it was just like this light going on, aha moment, where the insight is so glaringly apparent that we have the capacity to learn and teach ourselves, but it's all predicated on what's emphasized when we're young. Hmm. And that's where our learning curve, that's where our first, we're at the bottom of the stairs when we're young, so to speak, to sort of mimic your unconscious intention.
Right. And if we don't know what we don't know, our kids aren't certainly going to know what they don't know. And then even if we're competent about it, but if we're conscious about it, but incompetent, we don't even know where to go for it. We can't really teach anyone else as well. And I think that there needs to be that rising call for people to create that change and create that disruption in the current way in which we think about, you know, our own mental. And what you're talking about is people are obviously being aware of their physical at, you said 2 to 3. That's a remarkable story. But I think it really brings to light the gap in which the mental training and the mental fitness realm has to bridge. And there has to be significant disruption in the way in which people are doing it, because the way in which people are doing it hasn't been adopted widely, or it hasn't been adopted enough, because it tends to be still revolving around that medicine man or the reactive approach, right? Once something happens, then we go and do something versus, yeah, okay, let's make sure we're teaching our kids, hey, this is where the Band-Aids are, this is what's happening, and then teaching them how to use that correctly. So if something does happen, that they can also fend on their own. Kids are amazing. Kids are super absorbent, right? They are sponges at a very young age, and we can teach them significantly about their ability to handle their mental wellness and their mental fitness. But also as adults, we need to make sure that we're doing the same, because research has shown when you engage in your mental more consistently, you have a more fulfilling life. And more fulfilling life with reduced amounts of stress, that doesn't mean the amount of stress, the amount of stress that has the impact on you. I've said this before, Lee, you know, when you were 8 years old, what did a 30-pound dumbbell feel like?
Yeah, it felt like, you know, a giant boulder.
Right. It felt almost insurmountable. And again, I'm not going to assume your strength, but I'm assuming that you're stronger than when you were 8 years old. And that means that what does a 30-pound dumbbell feel like you? Yes. What does a 30-pound dumbbell feel like for you today?
Certainly not the same, right? Yeah.
It's not the same, right? It's lighter. It's easier because we've adapted. We've grown. And so the weight is the same. It's a 30-pound dumbbell nonetheless. The weight is the same. But because our bodies have adapted and we've grown, the weight has less impact. So similar, and let's go back to the ice shower up in Hamilton, New York, where you're freezing your butt off because it's a few centered degrees Celsius colder.
Yeah.
Coming back here, the weight felt different. It was the same, but the weight felt different because your body has adjusted, but you've also leaned into something that was more disruptive, more chaotic, more challenging overall. So what we need to encourage ourselves to do is to find that Hamilton, New York, right, cold showers. We need to make sure that we're leaning into a disruptive way. And I think a lot of times in the current way in which we think about mental, it tends to be, how do I remove that stress? How do I alleviate myself from those things? And there's value in that at times. But I think overall, that really elevates the stress and makes it more scary and more difficult to face. In comparison, when we lean into it, that's really going to create that change. When we lean into our conscious competence and we have to put out effort, yes, that's ouch. Yes, we have to learn. Yes, we have to grow. But that will allow us to have more of that unconscious competence. And that's going to allow us to lead to, one, a more fulfilling life. And having a more fulfilling life, as well as the reduction the impact stress has on you, can also lead to longer lives, more fulfilling relationships, improved communication. So we really want to stress taking care of your mental fitness is really about engaging with intention, challenging yourself like a nice shower. That's a simple way to do it. But there's a lot of different things that you can do. And we want to encourage throughout our talks to really encourage other people to share their stories of how they're leaning into chaos and how that might be able to be supportive of you and the head game that they're playing, right? That back and forth.
And it, just listening to you explain that, it makes me think that the few days that, for whatever reason, I didn't do my 7-minute ice shower, there's a noticeable difference. Because for a few reasons, you go back and you say, did I really not have enough time to do that? Well, why was that? Why did I make a commitment to lean into some discomfort, to engage with intention, to alter perception? And now that I didn't do that, am I different? Am I not as alert? Am I not as on point? And you would notice subtle differences. And I think it's so important to bring that to light, because there is a conditioning process. As you said, Hunter, when you're engaging more in the mental, there is research to support that a more fulfilling life is not if, but when. That does not make the amount of stress that you might be exposed to in your life any less. It just has less of an impact. Therefore, it becomes less of a burden. So you're still carrying, per se, the same weighted backpack, but your perception of disability, and I use that word with intention, not to be overly dramatic, but your perception of disability changes. And that's really the bottom line of mental fitness, of what it is to be mentally fit. Your perception of your burden, your perception of your challenge shifts. It alters because you are more mentally fit.